people are so unhappy, right? And they can feel the they're lonely, disconnected, disconnected from land, food, from each other, from community, living isolated lives, and a hunger for and to me, this is not a this isn't an accident of technology. This is a series of policy choices that we made. And so part of what I want to get across, I know it's not everything. I know that. I know it is that these policy levers aren't everything, but the anti-monopoly vision of returning to a plural economy with genuine local creativity and generativity, where people are free, not just free to go to the polls once a year, but live freely. It looks a lot different than what we have now.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I'm Lindley Dixon, co-director of the Real Organic Project. We're a grassroots, farmer-led movement with an add-on organic food label to distinguish organic crops grown on healthy soils and organic livestock raised on well-managed pasture. You just heard from Zephyr Teachout. Her book is called Break 'em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. And it was the inspiration for this year's virtual Real Organic Symposium that wrapped up this month. If you're a regular listener, you may have already heard Zephyr on our podcast since we've run her 20-minute talk from our Churchtown Dairy event, as well as the panel discussion she had on stage with Dave Chapman. Today, we're sharing the sit-down interview that Dave did with Zephyr late last year, where they dove deep into issues of antitrust. I personally appreciated their discussion about why it's still so important to fight for hard policy changes, even when it feels like those changes slip further and further away every day, which I experience all the time in this work. Political changes only come if you have a grassroots movement behind them. And so that's what we're trying to build here at the Real Organic Project. If you missed it, tickets are still available to watch the recordings of our annual symposium. So visit realorganicproject.org to watch the preview and find out all the details.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast, and I'm very happy today to be talking to Zephyr Teachout. Welcome, Zephyr.
It's great to be on the show.
Yeah, I'm such a fan of your writing, and it was great to have you come and speak at the Churchtown Conference last fall. And there's so much to unpack. I'm going to focus on your second book. So you've got two books, Corruption in America and Break 'em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. And I have to say, I'm curious, just to kick off, that you picked Big Ag instead of, say, Big Oil. What inspired that?
I have a lifelong interest in agriculture, as I think we all should. Dave, you and I actually were both farmhands at the same farm at a few years apart, but when I was in high school, the way I made money was working on farms, and I come from an agricultural, or formerly more agricultural community. So there's some part of it has to do with my own interest, but there's a few other reasons that I think when we look at monopolization in America, why it's so important to look at agriculture, and one is that in many ways, agriculture was kind of the canary in the coal mine for what is happening across our entire economic sphere. That the farmers, berry farmers, chicken farmers, commodities farmers across the board really experienced the squeeze pretty early on as the American economic policy shifted in the 1980s and 90s to a top-down concentrated power economic model. We can talk more about that. So there's real lessons and real wisdom in farming from that experience. And also, the problems of concentration in ag, and I think there's a few reasons for that, you know, the problems in concentration in ag and the effects of concentration in ag are well known in American history. The reason the Packer and Stockyards Act, an ag-specific anti-monopoly law, was passed in the 1920s was a real recognition that with perishable goods, producers had a greater risk of being squeezed out and abused and exploited by centralized infrastructure, that there are unique weaknesses in ag that make it easy for centralized distributors to really grab power. I got to tell you, though, just as a matter of communication, it is also easier to talk about ag, even though most people don't know anything about it, but they feel like they do. You know, they eat every day. They're connected to it. There's a deep connection. So that if we are talking about, for instance, what's happening with Uber drivers or what's happening with journalists on Facebook, the metaphor that allows people to feel like they have authority is to tell them the really horrible stories of what has happened over the last 40 years to farmers. The farmers play a really central role in the American imagination. And so that's a long answer, but there's a lot of reasons. Of course, the most important is ag itself. Like, this is the, you know, the center of our lives. You can get away with a lot of things, but you can't get away without eating. Having a food system that is a broken system, which it really is really fundamental to how our society is working.
Yeah. You know, when I was young, I actually grew up on a dairy farm down in Pennsylvania. And when I left...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Lancaster County, it's right in the heart of Amish country. And in fact, our farm is now owned by an Amish family that farms it. And beautiful, beautiful land and amazingly fertile soil. When I left that, I had no interest in ag. I had no interest in farming. And I certainly had no interest in food, in the food system. And when I came to Vermont, I got swept up in the excitement of the 70s and I got excited about organic farming and I became an organic farmer. So I still didn't quite get it about big food. And you know, when Monsanto was taking over, I didn't quite get it. What's this about seeds? But I've come to see, I've come to see how really important this is to everything, to democracy.
Everything. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, Monsanto is just one of many stories, but it's a very important story, is that the a friend and colleague of mine sometimes describes what happened in the 90s is like the second enclosure movement, right? Taking away from the public that which had been the public. And the court cases allowing for the ownership of seeds and the structure of seeds and the biological structure of seeds. It's such a radical part of this story as well. It's not what I focus on in my book, but within food, you find so many different parts of the distortions and tyrannies of the economic model foisted on us after the crisis of the 70s.
Yeah.
So you know, we're at a turning point right now, I hope, knock wood. but it's turning very slowly. We've got a lot of work to do. And as I write about in the book, Break 'Em Up, one of the things that was robbed, that was really robbed from our political discourse was ways to talk about corporate tyranny. We were kind of told that economics is for the experts and there's a real split. There's economic expertise and there's democratic expertise. And those two are different arenas. You know, it's a real lobotomization. So farmers in the 1870s, 1880s were leading the anti-monopoly fight. And so part of what we are also recovering is the long history of of anti-monopoly activism in this country and globally at this moment. That's exciting. And farmers have always been at the forefront of that.
Yeah.
Not alone, but always been central. They're absolutely central to the Granger movement, the early creation of the first federal utility, the Interstate Commerce Act and the regulation of railroads. That's farmer driven. A real creative, and creativity is important to me, and creativity is important to me as a vision of what a society should look like, right? But really creative and angry movements, building some of the real crown jewels of American government.
Okay. I want to dive into all of that. But first, just one last question, kind of as a setup. You say big ag in your title, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. And I actually mostly talk about big food now. I don't talk about big ag because agriculture is so embedded in distribution and retail that it seems like it really, we have to talk about that whole system.
Okay, so say a little bit more about that. That's interesting. I'm totally open to that.
Well, We face, one of the many crises that we face right now is a health crisis in America, which is certainly about food, but it's really something that's done in complete alliance between the retailers and the processors. And I think the farmers are almost innocent puppets in this. And so
So when I think about big ag, I'm not thinking about big farmers. I'm thinking about distributors. I'm thinking about Monsanto. I'm thinking about ADM.
Are you thinking about General Mills and the big processors?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, right. And those are all sort of collected. But I'm open to this because I think, I'm always interested in, as you know, I was involved in politics. And I'm still involved in politics, but not electoral politics for a while. And I'm interested in language that is really distancing, a language that's accessible. And I see how big food is like right away. You don't have to do any steps. You're talking about what's happening every day that people can touch and imagine. Yeah. So I really get the appeal of that.
And that system does not, it's not designed for our benefit. It's designed to profit off of us.
And
I think that's a really important thing. So big ag is part of big food. Let me ask the big question. So you think and talk a lot about democracy and how all of this bigness impacts democracy. And for me, this was my critical understanding because when I got into this, really I was still am just a small farmer. And I'm like, what's going on? Why are we seeing this one little bit of the food system that is ours, that we created, the organic movement? Why is the National Organic Program being deformed almost beyond recognition? And I came up to a failure of democracy because we, the people who created it, the farmers who are part of it, the eaters who are seeking out, none of us wanted this.
No. Let me tell you a story which sort of is both a true story, but I think is a parable that helps describe where we are. Same is true in berries, but I'll talk about it. I talk about in my book as chickenization. After the 1970s, the crisis of the 70s and a kind of crisis of confidence in democratic economic systems, when Reagan came into office, one of the first things he did is just ripped the bones out of antitrust enforcement, brought in people who basically, speaking of defunding, he basically defunded the antitrust cops. And there was a radical drop in enforcement, number of cases brought, the kind of cases brought, but probably as important, just a whole new theory. And the new theory was anything that is quote unquote efficient. So efficiency becomes this new kind of godlike North Star. Anything that we think is going to increase prices, bad. Anything we think is going to decrease prices, good. And we're going to assume that businesses are going to decrease prices. So there's a few different steps in there. Like they'll be out there in that raucous marketplace. They'll have to decrease prices. So if somebody wants to buy something up, they'll buy it up. This leads to radical consolidation in many different areas, but let's just talk about distribution in the chicken industry. And so as of really about 10 years ago, you now have four big players, I think Tyson or Pilgrim's, who sit as middlemen between farmers and the market. And if you are in an area, they kind of divide up the country a little like, you know, mob bosses. Here's your region, here's my region. And this is live produce, so it has to be near a processing plant. And after both gobbling up competitors and gobbling up different parts of the supply chain and the distribution chain, they then sit like little kings over the farmers, no longer cooperating in a marketplace, but really governing them. And this is what that means for contract farming, for chicken contract farmers. It means that they look free in the eyes of the law. They count as independent farmers. They count as sort of the American dream of you own your own land and you own your own, you can run your own business any way you want, but they can't use their own feed. They have to use whatever Tyson tells them. They can't use their own lighting system. What time you turn the lights up and down on the chicken? They can't use their own heating system. And then when they take the chickens or get picked up, they are paid different amounts every month in a thing called a tournament system. They're basically pitted against all the other chicken farmers in a contest who can most efficiently produce fat chickens for sale. But it's a contest where you don't actually get to know what your neighbors did. You don't actually get to talk to them. You don't even know what they're paid, and you don't know what you're going to be paid. So you're in this state of real rational paranoia where your how much you get paid goes up and down one week after the next, one month after the next, and you don't know if it's because you are in fact winning or losing in this tournament system. And this is where it hits the road on democracy. You know that if you speak up, you might be punished. So there's a recent case, it didn't get anywhere, which is part of the problem with the law, a farmer in Alabama who joins a organization designed to advocate for changing the laws. And she gets cut out of the system. She just loses the contract. And in 2010, when Vilsack and Holder came around to do hearings all around the country, a lot of farmers came. They did come and they told their stories. But a lot of farmers did that with terror, tears, real fear that telling their stories would lead to them basically going bankrupt. Because, by the way, they've been free to take out the $1 million loan on their chicken house. But that freedom means that they are constantly terrified that their entire world will collapse if they lose their contract. They need that contract. And so there's so many farmers whose tongues were effectively cut out by this system. They were living in a tyrannical system. Besides going to jail, the worst thing for most people is losing their job. But what's worse than losing your job is losing your job and going into debt. Like the duress that these farmers live under is extraordinary. And one of the things Montesquieu said is, who was a real, the Baron de Montesquieu, a real theorist who influenced the American rebellion against the Brits and setting up a system of distributed power, is that the signs of fear are the signs of tyranny creeping in. When you see farmers start to be scared, and when you see that fear, that is a sign that those farmers, it's really hard to come together collectively, because there'll be some that are brave and admire them. But I talked to a farmer who'd spoken up, And he tells stories of being shut out. Of course, you can't prove it because you're already living like in a panopticon. You're living where you can't know why you're being paid the way you're paid. It's a real state of being governed. And that should be totally antithetical to a democratic system, to be governed in that way. So, I mean, you know a lot about the work that the organic, the real organic, the work and the challenges. You've done an incredible job over the last few years. One of the things that you see in berries, for instance, or other areas, is that the big food, we'll call it big food, will allow some small sector of the market, 3-5%, you know, they'll allow them to exist and point to that as evidence that they aren't in control. We see this with beer too. You know, the beer industry is totally controlled, but they allow for a little corner of artisanal beer, right? But there's an element, a sort of gross element of grace, like they're sort of allowing them to exist, but we know we could crush you if we needed to, right? And that is also not democratic. Because the mechanisms, and I think there are some direct-to-market mechanisms that can't be crushed, but the mechanisms are by way of the grocery stores.
Right.
So if Driscoll, the grocery stores need Driscoll because Driscoll's the game in town, right?
Yeah.
They're not gonna have a grocery store without Driscoll berries. People will stop coming. So Driscoll has them over a barrel. And if Driscoll makes clear that you're not gonna carry that cooperative's berries, that cooperative's berries aren't going to be carried in that grocery store.
And we actually see that happening for sure. I just want to.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. Because, you know, even with Whole Foods, which is the closest to a chain that is an alternative to the other chains, and it's not, but I mean, it's as close as we have. But to sell berries to Whole Foods now, you have to go through the global buyer, right? You can't even sell to the regional warehouse, let alone the store, without permission from the global buyer. How did that deal come about, I wonder? So an interesting thing, Driscoll's themselves have amazingly claimed to be over 70% of the organic berries sold in America. But that was by their own claim. And I think somebody just wasn't thinking very clearly when she said that. I, that's more than Rockefeller had with Standard Oil when it was
deemed illegal. 64%. Yeah.
So that's right. Clearly a monopoly by any standard. And as I understand it right now, on the statutes, that's illegal.
So in American law, there is, you can gain market share of that level if you do it without using various anti-competitive techniques. So if And I don't know enough about the history of how Driscoll grew. It seems quite possible that mergers were a part of that growth. You know, you probably know that history. But American law does not ban the existence of 70% market share. It intervenes in a few different ways. It doesn't allow for the abuse of that, or what we call monopoly maintenance, basically. Engaging in behaviors that allow it to protect that power as opposed to just make better berries. And the challenge we have now, Dave, is that because for 40 years, yes, it was Reagan, but absolutely Clinton. Yes, it was Bush, but absolutely Obama. These were just a straight line with small variations on the theme of efficiency is the god. For 40 years, we now have concentrations like the one with Driscoll's that I don't know enough. I haven't investigated. I can't say it's not breaking the law now, but we have allowed this accumulation of power that our law, even aggressively enforced, won't always be able to address.
Yeah.
So, however, don't, you know, push me and others to look deeper in, you know, to what, you know, Driscoll's itself is doing, not just what percentage market share it has. I just want to, there's some of you who are probably sitting there, and I, speaking of language, it's an unfortunate feature of our antitrust language. Monopoly has the word mono in it. Mono, you guys are farmers, you're used to monoculture, mono, one, it has the word one in it. But it does not mean one. And you just gave an example of that. But there's no economist who would say that you need to be the only game in town to be a monopoly. What Milton Friedman, you know, the great recent book was called The Last Neoliberal, about Milton Friedman. I hope he's the last neoliberal, but what Milton Friedman, so the epitome of the efficiency consumer model of the economy, described monopoly as a company that has the power to unilaterally dictate terms or prices. So I can't speak to Driscoll's, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. They're not engaging in price negotiation with a grocery store. They are telling Whole Foods what the price is. You know, it's a dictation. So when you think of monopoly, you can have a monopoly at a much lower level, at 30%, 40%. If you can dictate the terms outside of, as opposed to making it a negotiation effectively.
You know, what I saw, and actually when I first encountered Driscoll's, it wasn't about price. It wasn't even about shelf space. It was about influence on the USDA. And I believe it's my personal belief that Driscoll's is the reason that hydroponics are permitted in organic certification. And if Driscoll's wasn't growing hydroponically, I think it would be banned and prohibited. And there was only one reason why it was permitted. And that was because the second biggest organic produce company in the world told somebody very close to the Secretary of Agriculture that it should be permitted. That's my belief. And that's, I have experiences to support that understanding.
Yeah.
I can't prove it because I would have to subpoena the person who was close to Vilsack and see if she would tell the truth under oath. But, you know, undoubtedly, I know for sure that there was influence being expressed. And I saw cases where I thought we were actually going to win in the beginning, which surprised me, until the people we were negotiating with realized that Driscoll's was growing hydroponically. And suddenly the conversation changed very much.
And so, I mean, I do not know. You have a lot more experience, but this is wholly plausible, right? And part of the, in some ways, it's just so crazy. Like, if you talk to any human, you know that you can't separate economic and political power. So there's this, you know, really fantastical idea in certainly in American history, but in world history, the idea that you can separate the two, that you can have a economic model that looks only at efficiency and doesn't worry about power, and then over here have election law, and, you know, ne'er the twain shall meet. Of course the twain meet, right? Of course they do. And as Justice Douglas in the Supreme Court said in 1950, all power tends to form into a government of itself. Mm-hmm. That there is always, that power is the question, right? And that when you have concentrated power, it becomes governing power. And it does so in two ways. One way is direct governing. That was the story with the chickenization story I was telling you. I know this happens in berry farming, that the berry farmers who are suppliers to Driscoll's are, some of them are probably Driscoll's employees, but a lot aren't employees, but they're fundamentally governed and they don't feel like they have free expression or can't be creative learning, engaging with the soil, engaging, you know, they aren't even allowed to learn. This is one of, I know I'm going off on a sidetrack, but it's one of the things that's so sort of maddening is the way in which even the sort of intimate knowledge that farmers have of their land stops being theirs. Mm. And then their ability to care for the land. And so that is one way, that governing way. But the other way you're talking about, which is so important, is that once you gain that power, then your levers over formal governing power become enormous. Some of the levers are the sort of crudest: funding campaigns. And a lot of times you don't need to, like if you're in a berry district, you probably don't need to fund campaigns. You just need the politicians to know that you could fund campaigns to destroy them. A lot of the money, power, and politics is latent. It's not used. It's just sitting there as a fearsome bear around the corner. And politicians do not want to unleash that bear. So they have the just direct power over campaigns. Then you have lobbying power. And lobbying power is enormous. And it happens in the direct way where there's the explicit lobbying meetings. But a lot of lobbying is what we call shadow lobbying. It's not on particular bills. It's insinuating yourself in the culture. It's reports, friendships, cocktail hours. And then companies like Driscoll's have another source of power, which is just the fear that if you pull the plug on them, that if you hurt them, you'll hurt the economy, or you'll hurt the part of the economy you're responsible for. So the too big to fail threat, so obvious in the banking crisis of 2008. You know, they said, you can't regulate us in certain ways. We get that you need to regulate us in a few ways. But if you destroy us, the whole thing goes up. You know, basically, we're holding you hostage. You know, you aim at me, you aim at the country, right?
Yeah.
And this, I believe, is, without knowing the particular claim you make, that there's no doubt that Driscoll's has that kind of power. That the fear of regulators, of taking on a company like that, that plays such a central role in the potential destabilization, that fear leads to a lack of regulation.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah, we see it. And so let me ask a related question, kind of the next step, which is, let me speak for someone who is dear to me. And they go, yeah, but, you know, people with very low income can shop at Walmart and get cheap food.
And yep.
Are you trying to take that away from them? So, you know, that this system, which I think is so destructive to those same people, and it gives them inferior nutrition, and it gives them, I actually think that system gives them a very low pay, right? That whole system that holds them down is also offered as a lifeline. What do you say to that?
Yeah. Well, there's two answers. I'll give you the easy answer first, but then let's talk about the deeper question. The easy answer is that after 2020, we have seen what big food does with its power. And what it does is, in a crisis, it raises prices. So the whole promise, you know how people like to say nowadays, they had one job. The whole promise of I'm going to use the Chicago school as shorthand, the efficiency, bigger is better, let companies self-regulate, that model, that, or you can call it the Chicago school. The whole promise of the neoliberal school was, but you'll get cheap prices, right? We're not going to talk about democracy, that's somebody else's job, but we can promise you cheap prices. Well, they failed at that job. And the consumer price index 2020 on, starting to come down. But what people were paying for meat, take Tyson, and I'm talking broadly. I was involved in the New York AG price gouging investigation, so I'm talking just from the outside, not about sort of from an investigative front, but from looking at the outside. They're in their reports to shareholders. They boast about their profit margins increasing during the COVID crisis and after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Their prices are going up and their profits are going up. There is a report that just came out by the Groundwork Initiative, which is a great group of economists researching this question of what's sometimes called greedflation. And they argue that half of the consumer price increases of the last few years are due to companies who do not have increased costs, just raising their prices. Maybe I'm being too complicated about this. Once you allow somebody to have a choke point power, they're going to rob from their workers and they're going to rob from the consumers. They're going to rob from the suppliers. Because once you have a choke point rule, you have nowhere to go. So yeah, maybe it's cheaper the first few years, but in the long term, the prices, it is not actually a protection against low prices. That's the easy answer, which is they tried, they failed. Diapers are too expensive right now. And that's because the diaper duopoly is basically, after having used its power to suppress worker wages, is now using its power to take parents and charge them more for each diaper. The deeper question, though, is not that. The deeper question is, and this is like the really long, hard work of collectively imagining an economy that we want to live in. The deeper question is, I don't have any doubt that monopolization leads to inequality. Oxfam, speaking of big food, came out with a terrific and devastating report about how consolidation in the food industry is a driver of global inequality. So you're going to have fewer pennies in your pocket when you go to the store, which is why you're going to want to go to Walmart in the first place. And the deeper question is, we don't want to live in a society where, price has a value, but it is not the only value. Being well paid, being secure has a real value. Quality, which is theoretically taken into account in current antitrust, but in practice, it's mostly prices. Quality has a value. There's a value in having local communities where you can go somewhere and buy socks downtown. There's a value in having a pharmacist that pays attention to your health needs and isn't wholly dictated. There is a value to having farmers who can use their knowledge to take care of the land and the food. And those are other values. And so the short answer is they failed, give us a chance. Right? And the longer answer is when we have that chance, now that we're starting to have that chance, it's hard if somebody's at the edge of a cliff.
Yeah.
But higher employment allows that conversation to happen. You know, when you have record levels of low unemployment rate, then you can start to have the conversation, but you have to have those record levels last. Because if people feel unstable and have $400 in the bank and, you know, nobody they can call to co-sign a loan, which is a lot of America right now. So I don't mean to undermine the first thing. It's like Tyson isn't getting a cheaper chicken right now.
Right. Yeah.
What do you think? I mean, this is not secondary for the Real Organic. This is sort of central to the Real Organic vision. Unless the Real Organic vision is we're going to be at 3% and we're just going to live in our corner and just leave us alone, which I know isn't your vision.
No, I'd like to be 50%, you know?
Yeah.
And our country would be better for it in almost every way. I see that. Have you ever heard of the Goldschmidt thesis? It was a very interesting thing. Yeah, it came out of California. It was a study done in some department of the USDA back in the 30s. And this guy Goldschmidt did a study of two towns in California. They're both agriculture towns, and they were both about the same population. And one town was completely ringed by corporate farms, large centralized corporate farms, and one was entirely ringed by small farms, family farms. And he looked at the difference of the two towns. Oh, yeah. This guy was alive until, like, you know, 1990 or something. And he did all kinds of other work, but that work was shut down by the government. They didn't like his punchline. His punchline was that the people who lived in the town with the small family farms was the town you wanted to live in. It had great schools. It had caring police force. It had public parks. It had lots of civic organizations. It had thriving churches. It had low crime rate. And the other town surrounded by the corporate farms was the town you didn't want to live in, the town that felt unsafe, the town where there was a lot of poverty, the town in which there was a big division between rich and poor, and the town in which most of the money actually went somewhere else because the people who owned those farms didn't live there.
Oh, that is so interesting. I mean, it sounds to me like it's like what happens with Walmart and dollar stores. They come in with promises that are about, you know, 1/80th of the elephant, and then the rest of the elephant is sick and dies. So, like, you got your patch. know, in that sort of which part of the, you got your patch, and then in the end, you usually lose that, that section too. But they're, what dollar stores are doing, what Walmarts are doing, they come in with promises, but the money isn't staying, the knowledge isn't staying, the sense of ownership isn't staying. And I don't know, look, there's a lot to be really worried about. I do think that we are in the theologian Paul Tillich called a kairotic moment, you know, a moment where it's sort of, you know, he's talking about in terms of the use of the word kairos in the Bible, but kairos as opposed to chronos, like just chronological time. And then there's times where there is a sense of possibility and opening. There's often a lot of chaos in those times, right? But there is a opening now for people are so unhappy, right? And they can feel the they're lonely, disconnected, you know, disconnected from land, food, from each other, from community, living isolated lives, and a hunger for, and to me, this isn't an accident of technology. This is a series of policy choices that we made.
Yeah.
And so part of what I want to get across, I know it's not everything. I know that. I know it is that these policy levers aren't everything, but the anti-monopoly vision of returning to a plural economy with genuine local creativity and generativity, where people are free, not just free to go to the polls once a year, but live freely. It looks a lot different than what we have now.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
It's a little about the individual tools and the great work that Lena Khan is doing at the FTC and the great work that it's a little about that, but some of it is about wholly changing the way that what we think an economy is for.
Right. Well, yes. Back to Schumacher, right? An economy as if people mattered. So tell me, because this is the hard question, in a sense. I mean, the easy thing is to go, look at what's happening, this is wrong. The hard thing is to say, I wonder what we could do about it. And, you know, it's not like you should have the answer to this, but I think that we're all wondering and almost desperate. People are truly, truly hungry to find a meaningful path that they could build the world that they want to live in. And people are scared. And, you know, a lot of people feel broke, a lot of people feel poor, but a lot of people feel threatened and in danger. So tell me your thoughts about, I don't know if we want to call it an anti-monopoly movement or a pro-democracy movement. I think they're the same things, right?
Yes, they are. So we are in the third year of the descendants of a real anti-monopoly movement having power in this country. And it can be hard to see depending on where you are, but a former agriculture reporter who wrote about both problems with Monsanto and chicken farming became a law professor and now runs the Federal Trade Commission. Mm-hmm. And so this is Chair Lena Khan. Now, you may think, she's not touching my life. I hear she wins some case. That seems very technical and distant. I will tell you who does not think it is technical and distant. The Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal has written an op-ed against Lena Khan 100 times as of today, since she took office. The financial elites who want to say that we have a competitive market, but really are controlling. They're sitting atop a market. They currently have both wealth and power. They know how threatening this is. And I say this because it is not simply a technical matter. Lena Khan's success in starting to challenge mergers, actually blocking those mergers, changing the vision of what our economic policy is a core attack on this top-down capital controls, people don't matter model, taking on private equity roll-ups, you know, where they buy up nursing homes and people have to sit in their own excuse my language, but, because the private equity does not care about the people in those nursing homes, taking on that another form of, and I'm using these words on purpose, is they want to tell you that this is an open, competitive market. This is a sclerotic, top-down, money-driven market. It is not open. And she is taking that on. So you have, and Jonathan Cantor at the Department of Justice, he's lost some cases, bringing price-fixing cases against distributors, but he's established great precedent to build the next case, and he is not part of, speaking of chickens, what we call the chicken shit club, the group of prosecutors who won't dare lose cases, because, but then they don't actually do anything, right? So their job, our job, our collective job, is to say, okay, I don't think about this. That's not my world. But we have, I think we have a very important job in saying yes and more. Like, they are taking on the heart of power. And there is nothing that capital would like better than for the rest of us to sit back and say, too complicated, antitrust, these are technical, doesn't affect me. There's nothing they want more than to say, doesn't matter. It matters. It really matters. When Joe Biden gave a speech, look, I think Bill Sack's been a disaster, right? Total disappointment. In other areas, Biden has been extraordinary on these issues. He gave a speech saying our last 40 years of trickle-down economics is a failure. That's an amazing moment. It's a failure. He didn't say, like, he wasn't nice about it. You could even see how angry he was. He's like, wait, we've allowed all this concentration. Workers aren't getting paid. This is a failure. We have failed at being... So you don't have to agree with Biden's own vision of market capitalism to cheer that on, but to recognize that Jake Sullivan from the Biden administration is saying the end of neoliberalism in the global order. Catherine Tai at the U.S. Trade Organization saying we're not going to negotiate, we're not going to use trade deals to stop regulation locally. It's a big deal, right? The ship is turning a little bit. And it can be hard because there's so much else you might want to complain about, but we got to get on board with at least, you don't have to approve everything, recognizing that that's a big deal and not wallowing in our own desperation. So that's one part of it. Another part of it is what farmers and others are doing in showing that it can happen, like showing what it looks like, even in a totally broken system. We got to be careful we don't pretend it's a broken, you know, it's a fixed system. And the third, and you and I had a nice debate about this on at the friendly debate
at Churchtown, yeah,
at Churchtown. But I really think, maybe because of what I was saying before, is that there's nothing more dangerous than feeling defeated by politics and feeling like it can't change. You remember Thatcher, Tina, there is no alternative, right? T-I-N-A. Do you remember?
I don't.
Okay. So Thatcher and the austerity politics of Reagan were defined by this slogan, Tina, there is no alternative. We have to go this way. Austerity is the only way we can survive. And at the time, you know, granted, I was like 8, so this is from reading, not from my memory. But at the time, the, you know, progressives and the left were like, no, it isn't Tina. There are lots of alternatives. There's lots of ways to build an economy. We can be involved in government. We can do these things. But I do sometimes worry that progressives have just, they bought Tina, but the negative version. It's like, unless we get rid of capital markets, we're done. You know, that they've sort of created a kind of impossible hurdle and therefore use that to justify checking out of politics. And we've got not to check out. So you aren't. I mean, the work you're doing is so central. It looks like right now you're losing when you're in your efforts at the Department of Ag. Sounds like it's not working.
We're losing in terms of governmental reform. We're not losing in terms of building a movement to create an alternative to that.
Right. Great. You're building the movement to create the alternative. And in building the movement, you are also making government reform more likely, and you're not stopping to push on the government reform. So you're doing these, and it's hard, and everybody's tired, and I get that, but it actually, it can change. 10 years ago when I was a baby anti-monopolist, I would never have believed that this chirotic moment would have put Lina Khan into the head of the FTC. Pete Buttigieg, McKinsey Pete, my goodness. Straight out of McKinsey, has sort of an austerity model, comes into the Department of Transportation. In the first 2 years, he sounds just like McKinsey. In the last year, Department of Transportation is suddenly doing its job. It's investigating Boeing. It's not allowing for self-regulation. It's looking into why there aren't flights into Burlington. it's sort of stepping up. I happen to know part of the reason why. There's a staffer in there who really matters.
Yeah.
Putting our people in, it's hard. It's not easy. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not magic. Putting our people in those positions does matter. The dissents, think of them as like building the dissents in the Supreme Court cases, Brandeis dissents for years, and then finally his vision of the First Amendment becomes the vision of the First Amendment. We complain about just-in-time, I do, crazy just-in-time model. It's a crazy way to build, it's a crazy and fragile way to build a economy. And it broke in COVID. Right. Efficiency. It's a crazy way to think about what the values of an economy are. Right? These are not human. But we can be impatient too. just understand that this could be a 60-year fight. I'm sorry, but and it matters. It doesn't only matter if you win in 5 years.
Yeah. Yep. I agree completely. 5 years ago, honestly, I thought, we failed so completely at government reform that I thought, well, we need to move beyond that. And I think that I still believe that, but I also think ultimately we can't abandon government. We need to create a better government. And so that's got to be part of our vision. It can't be our central vision because we'll all go out and commit suicide because, it's such a hard boulder to move. But I agree with you that if we are successful at building a real organic movement, ultimately the National Organic Program will either change or become so irrelevant as to not matter. And,
I feel like you sort of purposely tried to do politics and then you purposely doing non-politics, but now you're accidentally doing politics because the energy, once you build just as power tends to build into a government in itself, any community is a political community, right? Yeah. If you build community, that is political, right? And I'm saying then is that we have to be open to those moments. I certainly do not have all the answers, but there's reasons to think that there's an opening.
Yeah.
And from Delaware Joe. So wouldn't have expected that either.
Yeah. Somebody once asked Grace Paley why she kept going to these protests for world peace and always lost. And she said, well, what else could I do? And I feel that way. It's like, well, what else are we going to do except to try and create the world that we believe we should create?
Yeah.
Zephyr, I have a question. I had a really interesting experience. I was out in California a few weeks ago, and I heard talk by three of the founders of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. I don't know if you've
ever... Oh, wow. Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, you know them?
Yeah.
And they've got a fair food movement, and it's beautiful what
really
they've done,
exciting.
Right? It's really beautiful. And what was interesting was, in which I found fascinating in Break 'Em Up, you were saying this idea of... protesting, using your wallet, voting with your wallet, ultimately it was a little bit of a sideshow, and that we needed to move more directly to the cause of the problem, which was this concentration of power. And I agree. I agree with you. I thought it took me a while to get there. And I'm like, oh my God, we're missing the point here. The reason that this is happening and that we're working is a breakdown of democracy And the reason there's a breakdown of democracy is certain large corporations have way too much power. But what was interesting about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, they did the same thing for 10 years. They were organizing protests against the farms where these terribly abused farm workers were working, some of them in literal slavery. And they weren't getting anywhere. And they had a new idea. And for 4 years, they traveled around the country organizing people to protest against Taco Bell. They picked one company. Yep. And they said, let's get it that Taco Bell no longer participates in a system that is supported by slavery in America, where people are locked up in shipping containers at night, and which people are sexually abused, and which wages are stolen. And they went to all these churches and colleges, and they actually won. And after 4 years, Taco Bell signed the contract, and that was the first domino. And now they've got, I think, 12 major corporations, including Walmart, including Whole Foods, who are part of this. And it has really, as my understanding, transformed the lives of the people working in the tomato fields in Florida.
So it's a great example. And I honor that example. And maybe this is sort of an edited version of what I think. I want us to resist the neoliberal idea that we vote with our feet. We vote with our vote. We organize with our actual organizing. The idea that the market is the place to show our political preferences, as a general matter, no. And 90% of people's choices, especially because people are, as you say, having lived in this world, are living in on the edge there. They have very little savings. It doesn't make sense to have a moral expectation that people don't participate in Driscoll, Amazon, pick your target. Highly strategic, targeted, sustained boycotts can be extremely effective parts of an overall strategy. Both of those things are true. 90% of the boycotts we see are lazy, short-term, and call on the vote with your feet idea, and therefore reinforce a neoliberal vision. I don't like those. But if they are part of a strategy, as the Montgomery bus boycott was, as the sugar boycott against slavery in England was, that I talk about, there are boycotts that really matter. And so I should be more precise. I just in general, I'll double down on one part of it. There is research, which I don't think I had by the time of the book, but I've seen since, that people who engage in ethical consumerism are less likely to engage in politics. So if there's no scarcity, if you've got time for everything, do everything. Great. If there's a particular campaign that might actually change corporate behavior, great. But ethical consumerism as a way of living, as opposed to a part of a series of targeted campaigns, is doomed to be elite in a monopolized world.
Yeah.
So try boycotting cereal when you have two companies that control it. You're not going to get, you're not going to get a mass movement around boycotting General Mills. You might get some targeted energy if it's, am I making sense that?
Zephyr, you are making sense very much. And it reminds me from your book of your beautiful examination of Henry David Thoreau and Martin Luther King. You want to talk about that just for a minute? Do you have to go?
Yeah.
Have you got time?
I have to go fairly soon. Okay. Yeah.
If you would touch on that, because I thought it was such a clear demonstration of two really different outlooks about how you make your choice.
Yeah. So briefly, and they're both very worth reading, Thoreau and King are two of the most famous boycotters, right? And in this sense, I'm using boycott broadly, including civil disobedience. But the way in which they talk about it is really strikingly different. For Thoreau, who, had an influence on and King. It's not, they're not living in separate world. King wasn't critiquing Thoreau, I think took real inspiration. For Thoreau, a large part of his own discussion was appealing to or describing his own unwillingness to be part of a inhumane system, slavery. And it's extremely appealing and moving. King, by contrast, puts the boycott as part of a strategic effort and puts civil disobedience as part of a strategic effort. And in his letter to the Birmingham jail, he lays out the steps. You know, first negotiate and purify, the boycott, purity, purify not meaning like a weird kind of purification, but preparing for the conflict, preparing, but make it, he is very much part of a strategic effort to change policy, not to feel good about himself. And I want to feel good about myself.
To change policy, and I, to change policy rather than just to feel good about himself.
Just rather than just to feel good, yeah. Right, yeah. Just to change policy rather than. And so I just think the desire to feel like you're living with integrity is necessarily going to be part of a political desire, right? That you can't, I don't think you should just disrespect that desire. However, I think the real goal, the real moral goal, and King talks about this morality beautifully, is not, you know, he doesn't put it in the negative, I'll put it in the positive. It is to, it's just to change people's lives. It is to live in a just society, not just to live as a just person. And I think it is really worthwhile to think about the ways in which we have incorporated libertarian, individualistic worldviews when we engage in ethical consumerism, the outside of strategy.
Yeah.
Again, do it if you have the money and time. Like, there's no, like, absolutely.
Do it all.
And yeah. Yeah. It isn't meant as a critique. It is meant as a chastising and as a prioritization.
Yeah.
Especially after like the, you know, the Nike boycotts in the 80s, I think we got to start to feel like, oh, we got a shortcut. We don't have to do the hard work of convincing Vilsack of all people. Like, we could do a shortcut. We could do a boycott.
Yeah.
And they're, unfortunately, when you're talking about power, those shortcuts, they're not going to work.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's figuring out how to focus our energies to get where we really want to get to.
Yeah, and Zeynep Tufcheci, just on this, it's just given the very particular moment we're in, Zeynep Tufcheci writes about tech and protest and the ways in which you'll see a lot more boycotts come across your desk or your office or wherever you are than you did 15 years ago, just because the nature of the internet. So you'll see just like petition, boycott, and they're so much more fleeting than they used to be.
Yeah.
So there's a special reason to be wary and think strategically, because frankly, having been inside nonprofits and campaigns, you can use those as a way to, that is not strategic. You just use them as a way to build your membership email list, right?
Right, you sell outrage.
But that's not what you were talking about with the workers.
No, they were the opposite. About. They were very strategic and it took a long time for them even to understand where the leverage point was. And then it took another 4 years of the boycott to actually get that first major multinational to sign on.
I actually love that. I love that even better as a story now thinking about the time. So what I want people to do when I teach antitrust and democracy class, and so I'll leave you with this. I want people to see the world in terms of power. I want you to, when you read the news, think, yes, policy, but also like, oh, what's the market structure here? So, you know berries really well, but if somebody is just reading a story about berries, to ask the question, What's the power structure here, right? And that when you go deep in that boycott you're talking about, once you understand the power structure, first of all, then we can attack it. And then you can figure out the leverage points to build that world that we want to build.
Zephyr, teach out. Thank you so much.
Dave, thank you.
We'll do
so
this
much.
Again sometime because I got a lot of things we didn't get to, but thank you so much.
I next time I'm going to be calling you to interview you because I have so many more questions. Thank you for the work you're doing.
Wonderful.
All right. Okay. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Real Organic Podcast. Our movement is growing because you're subscribing and you're sharing these podcasts with your friends. So keep it up and leave us a rating and a review as well. You can find a video version of this interview on our newly designed website, realorganicproject.org, or on our YouTube channel. And you can join us every week for a new episode featuring voices from the organic movement. See you next time.